On KCRW, you're listening to Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiatakis with a show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. On a pothole-filled street in Boyle Heights, there's a warehouse that's now become a lab.
All right, so we want to be careful when we're going in.
Inside, chemists and engineers are figuring out how to take polyester that's been used in fabrics, pull it out, and package it for reuse. Why? Because polyester is made from fossil fuels. Yeah, oil. And it's in a lot of clothing, most of which just gets thrown away. Around the world, more than 1 billion items of clothing are produced every year. And 65% of it winds up in landfills within a year.
It seems so archaic to just dump material on the earth or just try and burn it and see what happens.
Shay Sethi is co-founder of AmberCycle. They're a fashion startup that owns this lab.
We've developed all these crazy technologies to make stuff. Why do we not apply those to the other end of the life cycle?
How does it work? And can new recycling technology make a dent in a giant polyester problem? Here's reporter Kirsten Zilm with the story.
Look at the labels of your clothes and you will see that most of them have polyester in them. Your workout shirts, your stretchy jeans, pantsuits, sweaters, and underwear. AmberCycle is on a quest to turn 100% of those clothes you don't want anymore into material for new ones.
So this is a sort of fairly standard chemistry lab.
Glass cylinders, tubes, and safety goggles fill the shelves. Sethi says recycling methods like those used for plastic bottles are not a sustainable solution.
Traditional recycling uses heat to melt and reform materials. Whatever was initially in that bottle is still going to be in that material after you've melted and cooled it back down. The quality goes down. You can't do that continuously.
AmberCycle goes a different way. They use chemicals for their recycling instead of super high temperatures. Step one is to extract polyester from the clothes. Step two turns it into a material factories can use to make new clothes.
The benefit of chemistry is you can do things at lower pressures, lower temperatures, and you can separate to a higher degree of purity these raw materials.
Sethi and his UC Davis roommate Moby Ahmed became obsessed with polyester during their college years. More than 10 years, several awards, and millions of investors' dollars later, they have streamlined their process to give discarded clothes new life.
Essentially what we're doing is we're turning the polyester into a liquid, separating it, pulling it back down to create this powder. The second step essentially turns that powder into a really pristine white polyester.
More precisely, they turn the powder into white, shiny pellets. They look like little beads. Garment producers can make yarn from them and then turn the yarn into new clothes. Once this process is perfected, the fashion industry can endlessly reuse polyester. That means less need to extract oil from the earth for garments. AmberCycle partners with eco-conscious fashion companies and designers. They also sell their own line of clothes. However, the startup is still far away from making a profit. It's depending on patient investors to get its operation up to scale. Their offsite factory produces 2 tons of recycled polyester every day, which might sound like a lot, but a typical T-shirt factory churns out 6,000 tons.
We're thinking on a very long-term timeline. We have so much more to do. It's like you make the first T-shirt and then you realize, how do we do this for 1 billion T-shirts? How can we replace this enormous industry's reliance on oil as fast as possible?
During his time in college, Shay Sethi says he was inspired by visiting entrepreneurs. Now he wants to pass on his knowledge to the next generation of students and let them know that not everything about waste in the fashion industry is doom and gloom. Recently, he handed out scissors to a group of design students from Otis College, Caltech, and Pasadena's Art Center College of Design. Then he told them to cut buttons and zippers from jackets, pants, and sweaters. The tedious work helps Jenna Coburn realize how many different kinds of materials can be in one piece of clothing. She recently graduated and received a grant to study sustainable fashion.
The fashion industry is like the second biggest contributor to global waste.
Jenna is used to turning her t-shirts into rags before she throws them in the trash. She knows that consumption comes with a cost way beyond the sticker price. But even Coburn admits that peer pressure sometimes overrides her reasoning.
Especially with social media, it's so easy to just see the latest thing and want to buy it. I do try to be conscious, but it's getting harder because I think the pressure to keep up with trends and stuff is getting more intense.
Animation student Elisa Borgarian found out the hard way how difficult it is to reuse polyester. For her materials class at Otis College of Art and Design, she has to come up with ways to use plastic waste for fashion items.
Plastic is very annoying to work with.
She envisioned a delicate necklace made from water bottles.
Initially, I was going to be making string out of them, but the little machine I made didn't make it thin enough, and it's not very malleable like string.
Elisa's teacher, Christina Opisleja, is impressed by the students' creativity. For her class, they make clothes and jewelry from all kinds of waste. Coffee grinds, shredded paper, orange peels, pineapple leaves, Epsom salt.
For me, every class, every week is like Christmas. I come to class and I see some newly developed objects and I never would have thought about it. And yeah, my students are able to create this excitement for me.
Opisleja is glad she can show alternatives to material waste, worker abuse and overconsumption in the fast fashion world. There are scientists and designers around the globe working on ways to make the industry healthier for people and the planet. But so far, they are the exception.
This is still an issue, very frustrating for me as a researcher or educator, and of course frustrating for my students or aspiring designers that you can't get the materials to design with.
Well, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
Jenna Coburn says seeing blended materials turn into white polyester beads was encouraging.
Knowing that there's a way to take the mistakes we've already made, so to speak, and then basically reverse them, undo the damage we've already done, makes me feel like there are technical solutions and there are good people working on them, and it makes me calm down a little bit.
She's determined to become part of the solution, not the problem, while still having fun with fashion. For KCRW, I'm Kerstin Zinn.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is calling for a pause of Israeli airstrikes in Gaza to allow for humanitarian aid to get through to the people of Gaza. Comes weeks after attacks by the terrorist group Hamas inside Israel and a cataclysmic response by Israel. And the world goes on with all kinds of reactions, including right here in Greater Los Angeles. 2 weeks ago, we had Rabbi Susan Goldberg of Nefesh and Salam al-Mariati of the Muslim Public Affairs Council on the show to talk about the impact on people here locally of the war now going on between Israel and Hamas. And since then, the city has seen protests in support of both sides and a lot of heated words, and even worse, on the streets and on college campuses, too. So today we want to take a moment to talk about how to reach beyond the heat and beyond the high emotion and actually have constructive and positive interfaith dialogue. And what that could look like, or what that should perhaps look like. One local organization called New Ground was created for exactly this purpose, to promote relations and dialogue between the Jewish people and Muslims in Los Angeles. The group calls itself a convener. It runs trainings and classes promoting interfaith engagement, And we have a couple of representatives from the group on right now. Tasneem Noor is program director over at Newground. Tasneem, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Steve. Happy to be here.
And Shahar Cohen-Hodes is a facilitator with the group here with us as well.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Tasneem, you bring together people from the Muslim and Jewish communities to foster dialogue and relationships. I know there's a lot of sensitive stuff, right, with all of this. Even on good days, it's very sensitive. These are not good days, for sure. I can only imagine that it's particularly challenging for you to get the word out. What are you finding?
The challenges are real, right? The pain is real. The grief is real. The anger is real. Nausea is real.
There actual are physical.
Physical.
Right?
Yeah, like at night when I feel like my body just achy and heavy. Like that's how it's showing up for me. Others are saying I'm dizzy. Others are saying I'm forgetting. Like there are physical implications on our bodies as we witness the horrific brutality and violence and loss of life in Gaza, in Israel. And it's hard to sit with and process. And for some, it's very personal, right? It's family members, it's friends. It's not just something from afar. I think there is an internal struggle happening, right? Like everyone's in this place of what is my responsibility as I witness this atrocity happening. And we're finding people, some are going inward and getting quiet. Some are getting very loud. And some people are reaching out to the people that they feel comfortable reaching out to. And the social media is not a reflection of how all the Muslims and Jews are processing and holding compassion for one another.
Is it? It's one of those things where I see this all the time in the news, and it's very hard to separate what's happened with the politics of the region, right? We know what happened in Israel on October 7th was horrific. There were terrorist attacks inside Israel. People were taken hostage and people murdered. And also what's happening in Gaza is horrific. The airstrikes and I mentioned it, cataclysmic. You can't look at it and not be just horrified by what's going on the ground. How do you separate that in people, in groups, from the Israeli government, from Hamas, which is labeled by the State Department as a terrorist organization?
I don't know if I have all the answers. This is how I do it. I think for me, there is the macro of what's happening. There's the historical, the context. There is the current reality. All of that is true. And at the end of the day, I have to sit with myself and say, how am I going to show up in the world? And how am I going to see people beyond countries, beyond labels? How am I going to see people and how do I want to relate to people? And when I do that, I want to honor the pain. I want to honor the anger that is there in people. I want to honor the call for justice that people have. And that's, I think, the work that we begin to do is you get grounded yourself. You process and do what you need to do to get things out of your system. And then you get quiet and say, how do I want to show up? How do I want to relate to people? And authentically, sincerely, as fully as possible, which is really, really vulnerable, to ask these questions and to be open to having these conversations with others.
Shahar, you're now working as one of the facilitators, right, in the program called MAGIC. You work with high school age students every year, Muslims and Jewish students who are trying to inspire change. That's what MAGIC means, right? Muslims and Jews inspiring change. A few years ago, you were a high school student, right?
Yes, I was. I was a high school student in magic. I was actually in the first cohort of magic, and I take a lot of pride in having been part of the group that named it. And what we do is every year we bring a group of Muslim and Jewish high school students together to be able to learn from one another, both like learn what it means to be a high schooler from somebody else's point of view.
It's already tough being a high schooler, isn't it?
Sure it is. Yeah. It sure yeah. is. And then learn about what Islam and Judaism means to each person. Really think about the ways that anti-Muslim and anti-Jewish bias show up in our students' lives and in the world. And then gain tools alongside that to be able to navigate really challenging conversations around all of those topics. And once we're kind of deep in relationship with one another, have those tools, really explore Israel and Palestine, both the history and what's happening at the given moment that we're in relationship with one another and then in this cohort, and really learn as high school students what it looks like to engage in dialogue, but also to hear perspectives that aren't your own, just for the sake of really being in deep relationship with one another and for being able to have those tools and expanding our understandings of ourselves and one another. And one of the gifts of this program and this work in particular is that you get to be seen by someone who you've been told doesn't understand you. And the gift of that, I can't even explain how powerful it is. So I think, you know, in high school, social media is a really challenging place to engage in conversations. And I think that magic and Newground has given me a space and a framework to understand the importance of actually engaging in conversations with people you don't agree with or don't understand often.
In that organization, in magic, you see faces. You actually, because that's the difference between social media, right? You're sort of a keyboard warrior. And social media, you're just, yeah, I can write whatever I want and my avatar is, you know, Pokemon and I can say whatever I want. But that's not the case when you're face to face with somebody.
Certainly. I think, you know, we were talking about, we've been talking in Newground about kind of what the role of social media is in this space. And I think, you know, especially in America, it feels like there's so little we can control right now. And one of the avenues we have to share information, to share our thoughts really easily and accessibly, and to do some of what people feel is activism or advocacy is on social media. And that's a really accessible place. But what social media does is you lose that face-to-face communication. You lose the ability to hear the tone in someone's voice. And also what you can do in conversation is say, like, wait, can we pause a second? That word you just used is bringing up something for me. It's really hard to do that in the comments section of a Facebook post or an Instagram post or a Snapchat. That ability to say something you said harmed me, I care about this relationship and I want to figure that out, is often lost on email chains, listservs, et cetera, et cetera. And I've seen people be able to do that, but it's an art form and it's really hard.
Yeah.
And it gives this level of distance and an impersonal, you know, way to be in communication with people when you're focusing on the internet.
Are you concerned for the safety of students in school with what's going on? Threats of violence, which we've seen before?
Yeah, I'm really worried about the way that polarization and our kind of leaning towards dehumanization of people who aren't our people, whatever that might be, can lead to violence. I think that one of the most important things that can come from conversations, from engaging in conversations with people, is a humanization of them, an understanding of their hopes and their dreams, of what they care about. I'm really worried about both the rise in Islamophobia and anti-Semitism. I'm really worried about the inability for some to see the rise of one of those or to acknowledge the pain of either one of those and the real impact it has. And I think my engagement with Newground has allowed for me to be able to hold so much pain at one time, so much fear, for all of the people I love and care about in this space. And that capacity to, you know, hold multiple truths at the same time is something that comes from this dialogue, from these deep relationships amongst Muslims and Jews in a way that doesn't compromise our conviction or care for one another.
How do you do that, Tasneem? Yeah. How do you?
I think first thing first is that in order to come together, there can't be an expectation that you're going to leave something outdoors, outside, you know. When we are in relationships, in order for the relationships to work, for that dialogue that Shachar is describing to work, you have to bring your full self. And we have to be willing to see the other person in their fullness. And I think that's why I love, you know, what you were both just sharing, that sense like when we are face to face, we see the full person. So I think it's really, really important when you're in dialogue to be authentic and sincere and have the space to bring your full self to the table and not leave anything out. Because a lot of times there's this idea that interfaith is for preaching to the choir. It's about, oh, all is good. Oh, you know, we pray the same, we eat the same. Like, let's just come together and dance. I don't think that's what it is. There has to be a willingness and capacity to name the differences and wrestle with what those differences are. And after a decade or more of doing this work, I can tell you that, yes, sometimes it's hard, but it's also a big blessing. It has made me stronger in my faith as a Muslim by interacting with the Jewish friends and Andrea and Shachar and, you know, everyone. It makes me question things. It helps me to see things in a way that I would otherwise not do. And I'm really, really grateful for that aspect of resilient relationships where you can be fully present with one another.
Empathy, right?
Empathy and courage.
I think we forget about empathy, though.
Yes.
That we can walk in other people's shoes, too. And we can relate to things happening.
Yes. And if I may, like, I'm seeing both, I'm talking to a lot of people right now, Jews and Muslims, and I'm seeing both of them asking for that empathy. They just want to know that we are seen and that we matter. And just because we're Israeli or Palestinian doesn't mean our lives don't matter, right? They do. They do matter. And while we each want that empathy, it's really hard right now to express that because there's so much pain and so much anger. And so what I would say to that is that that's okay. Just don't lose sight of it. Just don't harden so much that you don't even want to be empathetic to one another. If this is not the time for you to reach out across the aisle, okay. Take a break, take a pause, but be open to it.
Tasneem Noor and Shachar Cohen Hodes from Newground, thank you both for coming on and talking with us today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
It's Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The spooky, creepy season is upon us. Halloween, of course, is coming right up. And here in LA, the Nature Nexus Institute is working to prove that some of the creepier critters who live throughout the city and the county and the region aren't actually all that scary. With me to talk about all things creepy and crawly is their community programs director, Emily Kobar. Emily, you have a big walk coming up, don't you?
Yes, I have a hike coming up on Thursday at the Baldwin Hill Scenic Overlook. As a lot of people know it as the Culver City Stairs.
The Culver City Stairs, right? Where you can see, you actually see the city of LA, right? With the mountains. It's
yes.
One of those vistas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. At the top, you have one of the best views of LA.
Tell us a little bit about what the Nature Nexus Institute does before we get into the creepy crawliness of it all.
Nature Nexus, we provide free programming for the community. We do field trips at our sites. And these are sites that, you know, people might go to on the weekend, where people might go hiking or fishing or just any type of other recreation. But in our programs, we give people a different perspective of these very common areas and talk about the wildlife that live there. We do nature walks for the community, and we also focus a lot on habitat restoration and provide opportunities for people to do hands-on planting of native plants. And
getting people involved and interested in nature, right, is sort of the thrust of what y'all do.
And yes,
again, this spooky critter stroll that you're doing this week, talk a little bit about the things that you'll see in nature that may scare you. They look really scary, but you shouldn't be scared of them.
A lot of the spooky critters that we like to focus on include bats. A lot of people are afraid of bats, but we like to demystify that fear. It includes even opossums, rats, and then if we're talking even in a smaller scale, we're talking about praying mantis and spiders especially. And right now it's spider season, so they will be a definitely highlight of the hike. They're going to be the most common species we're going to be seeing on there.
Like what kind of spiders, Emily?
We have this huge spider called a catface spider. Really beautiful color, but really
it's
huge
called catface,
too.
Really?
Yeah, it's called a catface.
Wow.
And we have a little small like guide that we worked on that we can people can see as well. And then we might be seeing a lot of long jawed orb weavers.
But those spiders aren't venomous, right?
Technically, all spiders are venomous. However, they're not potent enough to harm us humans. They're because they use that venom to eat their prey. That even includes black widows. So yes, I think there have been some cases where people have gotten sick from it, but it's not common at all. And as long as we're observing it and not, you know, touching them or anything, they will respect our space as well.
Yeah, this isn't the time to go pet your spider day, right? I mean, that's
yeah, exactly. And the park also houses other animals that people may consider scary, like snakes.
Yeah, and you never know when you're going to see a snake, especially on a hiking trail.
The thing is that we like to focus that we're visiting their home and they won't harm us. Like snakes, and I think it applies to many animals, is that they're not aggressive, they're defensive. So as long as you're not like poking it with a stick, you're not, you know, doing stuff, you're just simply just observing it. If you want to come close to it, they won't do nothing to you. And a lot of these animals are really important to our space because a lot of them are either pest control. Spiders eat many insects. Bats eat mosquitoes. I know a lot of people hate mosquitoes, and some of them are non-native and invasive. And bats control the population to mosquitoes.
We could use a few more bats these days, I'll tell you, with the mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's really important to respect, you know, critters, even though they look, you know, creepy and scary and are maybe a pest, but they're really important to our ecosystem.
Well, the stroll is just in time for Halloween on Thursday over at the Baldwin Hills Overlook, the Culver City Stairs, as it were. Emily Kobar, Community Programs Director for Nature Nexus Institute. Emily, thanks for coming on and talking with us. Good luck with the walk and the hike.
Thank you. Yes. And anyone who may be interested, come on by. We are going to welcome you and you will learn something new. So I hope people get to join.
All right. More information, by the way, on the hike and the Institute at our website, kcrw.com/GLA.
And by the way, tell us how you're doing. Maybe you have a story idea. Want to check out the podcast? You can do it all at the website, kcrw.com/GLA. If you want to search for the podcast wherever you get your podcasts, you can do that by searching KCRW Greater LA. Just put those terms in, and we hope to be on the go with you with our podcast, Greater LA. Tomorrow on the program, in February, rent-controlled apartments in the city of LA could see rents go up as much as 8%. That could be tough on a lot of renters, of course. If you're one, you know. But landlords say they're suffering financially, too. We'll have that story tomorrow right here on Greater LA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Celine Mendiola, Kelsey Gante, Eddie Sun, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Sue Margulies, Amy Todd, Carlos Ramirez, Evan Ray, and Christian Bordall all helped run this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ear. Have a great night.